This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with John Bel Edwards, state representative from a meet, leader of the House Democratic Caucus, and candidate for governor. And the election is now less than 13 months away. We'll talk with John Bel Edwards about some of his concerns, including one regarding the Office of Group Benefits. Yesterday, the former health secretary for Governor Jindal, Bruce Greenstein, was indicted. We'll talk about this and more with the fabled political consultant, Gus Weil. And Michael Rubin, his book, The Cotton Crest Curse. Michael Rubin practices law full-time, and he's a former professional jazz pianist. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. Your outside number is 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. And you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Frank Barnett is producing, and our leadoff guest is the fabled political consultant, Gus Weil. Good morning, Gus.
Good morning, Jim.
Well, first of all, before we get to politics, I know you follow LSU football religiously. What happened to your Tigers Saturday night?
Well, I want to tell you, I predicted that they would lose. I told a very close friend of mine, Roland Laura, who will verify what I'm saying, and I want to tell you why I thought they would lose. They showed no improvement over the three games that they'd played. They were kind of listless in it. Methodical, and I did not think that they would be charged up for this game because I think they believed in their own publicity.
Well, they lost to Mississippi State. Actually, in the last generation, they've only lost twice to the Bulldogs, and so it kind of puts a downer on the season. But this week, LSU should recover nicely against New Mexico State.
But what an accomplishment, you know. That's like playing a high school team.
I agree with you. I think U-High with Manny Miles at quarterback would be a more formidable opponent.
Absolutely. But everything was wrong. For example, our running back, the number one recruit, he hasn't lived up to anything thus far. Our quarterback is very poor. I see no fire in him. And I don't know. I think Miles has a real bad situation on his hands.
297-5633 in our time with Gus Weil. HB in Denham Springs. HB, good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Weil, I just finished Leo Honeycutt's book on his biography of Edwin Edwards. Have you read it, and if so, what is your opinion of it overall? Thank you, sir.
I think that's the Leo Honeycutt biography. I think was one of the finest pieces of professional writing that I've ever seen in Louisiana. I thought it was a classic.
A classic.
Yep.
And, of course, Edwin Edwards has parlayed that book as part of his redemption tour, which includes a run for Congress. And as we segue into politics, the election's 41 days away. And probably on November 4th, Edwin Washington Edwards will run first in the primary of 13 candidates in the 6th Congressional District. The more things change, Gus, the more they stay the same.
The more they stay the same. Boy, are you right. Wow, the street savvy says that Edwards will run first and then be eliminated when all of the Republicans coalesce. There's so damn many of them.
Well, we'll have a lot to talk about in December, I'm sure, and it'll likely also include a runoff featuring Mary Landrieu and Bill Cassidy. Yesterday, the governor of Louisiana, Bobby Jindal, had a setback. That's the story beyond the story here. His handpicked Department of Health and Hospital Secretary, Bruce Greenstein, indicted on 9 perjury counts. This is an office that the governor of Louisiana held himself under Mike Foster. And it would appear that if Mr. Greenstein is guilty of what he is charged, the governor of Louisiana either A, didn't know about it, which doesn't reflect well on him, or two, was complicit and might face some kind of grand jury proceeding himself. So this cannot be good news for the man who is destined, according to some, to be the next president of the United States. What do
yes,
you think?
Well, don't make any bets on that. Don't bet on that sure thing.
Well, what does this mean, if anything, politically?
Nothing, because he's no longer a factor in state politics, national politics. He's just used himself up. I don't know what happened. He started with so much promise, and he was so very bright, and everyone acknowledged him to be a prodigy. But somehow it just fell apart.
But he is running for president, there's no doubt. In fact, I think he may be in New Hampshire as we speak. Generally, Louisiana governors just don't saunter off to New Hampshire without some provocation.
Well, he's campaigning very hard. I think the two hardest campaigners are he and Edwards.
Well, Edwards stays in Louisiana. And another Edwards will be with us shortly, running for governor, John Bell Edwards. There's been so much attention about the Senate race and the congressional races that we have, in some ways, neglected to talk much about next year's governor's election, which is now just 13 months away, less than 13 months. Gus, as you know, in the old days, people would campaign for 2 or 3 years in the quest to be governor of Louisiana.
I think that Darden is going to surprise Vitter. And Darden is what I call a still walker. You're not aware of what he's doing, or where he's campaigning, or how he's campaigning, and all of a sudden he's caught you. He is a really good politician.
He's in the LSU Journalism Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
As are you, Gus Weil.
Yeah.
And he's Jewish.
Yes, so am I.
So he's like a son.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know if that's enough to make us blood relatives. Mm-hmm.
But you do have a few things in common.
Yes. I think that I think he's going to make a good race. And I'll tell you what else. I believe that Mary Landrieu, I still predict, will win.
Barry in Mid-City. Good morning, Barry. You're on with Gus Weil.
Good morning, and Lashana Tova, Gus. Happy New Year.
Thank you, sir.
So, Gus, on the eve of the Jewish New Year, the United States is now in another war. What do you think is going to be happening in this new campaign against IS?
Well, you know, I think that we had no choice. And I think that Obama handled it beautifully. He took off and didn't rush and into anything. And I think that he has shown some real leadership. For example, that's the first time that I've seen 4 or 5 Arab countries join America's coalition. That's really quite extraordinary.
Well, the president has been tarred and feathered, but on this one, the opposition has been somewhat tepid to this point. And when it comes to matters of national security, maybe this is one occasion where people will think that they're Americans first and partisans second.
It's possible.
You know, yesterday I was speaking of partisanship, Gus, and this is something for you to chew on. There was a column in the New York Times stating that 49% of Republicans would not want their daughter or son to marry or date a Democrat, and 33% of Democrats would not want their kids to get involved with a Republican.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, isn't that something?
I wonder what, you know, that's playing hardball. Wow.
Literally.
I can't imagine why anybody would let their prejudices show in a situation like that. I really can't.
Well, it wasn't like that a generation ago or two generations ago.
No, it was not.
What happened?
The whole picture's changed. I don't know. We've gotten to be a cynical people. I think our times are quite worrisome.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not at all feeling good about what's going on in our political life in America.
Well, one listener says talk radio has contributed to this, and she is probably right. Specifically, Mr. Rush Hudson Limbaugh III. Now, he, in his case, Gus, he's married four Republicans. Maybe he ought to try a Democrat.
Well, you know, he ought to. But I don't know if any Democrat would have him.
Major announcement from the Cassidy campaign. They just sent an email saying that Dr. Cassidy will get a big endorsement today. It's coming right after the show. Who could this be from?
Well,
are you going to endorse him?
No, not this time. I wouldn't endorse him if I was given a large sum of money.
Okay. Well, I would imagine it could be Governor Jindal. It could be,
yes.
But I doubt it. At least
could
not
be Mike Foster.
Could be Mike Foster. Could be Henson Moore. Could
yeah.
be any number of prominent Republicans, and it probably will be. But it would be nice if for once when these endorsements were rolled out, like it would be nice if some Republican endorsed Landrieu, and she did get a few with Boise Bollinger and Joe Cannizzaro, or if a Democrat endorsed Dr. Cassidy.
I thought that Bollinger's spot and strategy was simply wonderful. One of the best ads I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Well, it apparently helped the senator for a while, but she used that first in her campaign. Some consultants have said she should have waited a little. She kept her powder dry and used that a little later in the campaign.
Well, I don't know. Goodness.
All right. What about the keg story? That's another question from a listener about Mary Landrieu being involved in keg activity before the LSU football game Saturday. Imagine drinking before an LSU football game, Gus.
Shocking. It's shocking. How can somebody drink before an LSU football game? How can somebody stay sober?
Well, after they watched the game, they probably wanted something to drink.
No kidding.
Maybe
wow.
But Gus, the fans filed out, and the announced crowd was 102,000, but the real crowd was maybe 80,000. And then by the end of the game, it was between 15,000 and 20,000, and about 5,000 of those were from Mississippi State. What
yeah.
if LSU had pulled out that game in near seclusion?
Boy, LSU, I've never seen them so discombobulated, I really haven't, as they were in that game. Miles has been a splendid coach, but he sure would have spent it the other night. Nor was his defensive coordinator, nor his offensive coordinator.
Yeah, it was not a stellar performance from the coach and his staff or his players, and I think he acknowledges that, but we shall see what will happen the remainder of the season. LSU will win this week and then go to Auburn, and that one will be a tough one.
A really tough one. I don't think that LSU can beat any team that has a good quarterback.
Well, there are
really, and once again, we don't have a top quarterback. With all our great recruiting, it just hasn't panned out.
Well, Gus, thank you so much, and we will
Jim,
talk soon.
Well, Jim, it's a pleasure, and I thank you, sir.
Well, we'll talk soon. Gus Weil. And we shall return with John Bel Edwards, candidate for governor and state representative, who is taking aim what's going on with the Office of Group Benefits, and we'll talk with him about that and more when we return after this 90-second timeout on WRKM. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. John Bel Edwards, candidate for governor, state representative from AMEET, leader of the House Democratic Caucus, is with us. And we, as we talked with Gus Weil, John Bel Edwards, we're less than 13 months away from the primary next year. Talk about getting close. You're in full bloom as far as your candidacy for governor.
You're right, Jim. And first of all, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be on with you and your listeners this morning. And we are certainly working hard and traveling the state. And 13 months will pass by faster than most people can imagine, I believe.
Who do you view as your principal challenger or challengers?
Well, I mean, it's right now there are two, obviously, and that's Senator Vitter and Lieutenant Governor Darden. I don't believe anybody else has announced up till now, and I think they're both worthy and will be serious challengers and opponents.
And they're both Republicans. Right now you have the Democratic field cleared, and I'm sure you'd like to keep it that way.
I would, and I'm working hard in that regard, and that's one of the reasons why I've been out for about a year now, traveling the state and meeting with different folks and trying to get their support. So that there hopefully won't be room left for other challengers on my side of the aisle.
I don't think Jim Bernhardt's going to run, and he gave it some serious consideration, but then there's Mitch Landrieu. Any concern that he might jump in the race?
Well, I don't. First of all, with respect to Mr. Bernhardt, he hasn't told me that he's not running, and so I don't know that to be the case. Obviously, I hope that he don't, and I'd like very much to have his support. I consider him to be a friend and certainly someone who's very accomplished. As for Mitch, you know, on the Thursday before his reelection in February of this year, he pledged to serve a full term if elected. So for me, that ended the matter, and I take him at his word, and I think everybody should.
Well, John Bel Edwards will be a formidable candidate, and he has run this race with earnest for well over a year, and we're getting closer and closer, and much more attention would be on the governor's race if there were not a Senate race this year. But you have said that you think David Vitter would be Bobby Jindal on steroids.
I do, and if you are not satisfied with the direction the state's been heading under Governor Jindal, I don't believe you can possibly take a chance on Senator Vitter, because every time he's criticized the governor, it's because the governor didn't cut enough, close enough, privatize enough, sell enough. He just hadn't hurt enough people. And I don't believe that that's exactly what the people of Louisiana are looking for today. And a primary example of that is what Governor Jindal is trying to do to state workers and school teachers and retirees right now in the Office of Group Benefits.
Well, you had a meeting last week, I think, with the Attorney General, and there have been some developments since then. What is going on with the Office of Group Benefits?
Well, what happened was that a couple of years ago, there was a very healthy fund balance of about $500 million in the Office of Group Benefits to pay claims for the 230,000 members. These are active state employees, school teachers, university professors, and retirees around the state. Despite the fact that health care costs were rising 6% a year on average, the administration cut premiums by 9% over 2 years, in an effort to save money that could be spent elsewhere to help balance a budget that was very, very tight. But in so doing, they created a negative cash flow. And right now, the program is bleeding $16 million per month. As of the end of last fiscal year, or I should say July 1st of this year, the fund balance was about $200 million. And so it's a self-created crisis where through mismanagement, and really that's probably not the wrong word, I think by design, they drained the fund balance, and now their answer to fixing the problem they created is to make our OGB members pay substantially more in out-of-pocket costs for substantially fewer benefits. And I think that that's the wrong approach, and Further, I am convinced that the way they've gone about it itself has been illegal because they have not followed the Administrative Procedures Act, specifically the rulemaking provisions within the Administrative Procedures Act, which are designed to make sure that we have a public notice, opportunity for the public to provide feedback and input, public meetings, and legislative oversight that is meaningful. And so I think there's a real problem moving forward because, as you know, Jim, they are planning an enrollment period starting in October, October the 1st, on plans that are not valid. They have not been finally promulgated, and I think that's a problem. And they cannot go through the process by January 1st, which is when they want to implement these new plans.
What does this opinion from the Attorney General do?
Well, it confirms my own independent opinion from earlier that they have proceeded in an illegal manner. And further, if they persist in doing that, at the end of the day, everything they seek to do will be null and void and ab initio, which means it's of no effect whatsoever. And so they really need to back up, in my opinion, and they need to slow down and do this right. And even if they have to delay it for 2 or 3 months or whatever it's going to take to actually get through the process legally, if they don't do that, they risk doing all this and having a court declare that what they've done is without effect at all. But by following the law, there will be transparency, there will be accountability, and there will be oversight through the process. And if they go ahead and they have people choosing plans in October that are not final, then that just means that they have no regard for the Administrative Procedures Act and the requirements set forth in law, because they're going to be treating as final plans that by definition are not, which means that they don't really care what the public input may be or what the result of a public hearing or a legislative oversight committee meeting might be. They've already made their determination without having gone through all those steps, which clearly is not consistent with the intent of the law.
297-5633 for John Bel Edwards, state representative from a meet and candidate for governor and the leader of the House Democratic Caucus. Now, what's going on with the former Secretary of Health and Hospitals being indicted? Is this a major development, or is this just a non-story at this point?
Well, it's certainly not a non-story. If you're Bruce Greenstein, I think it was 9 counts of perjury, 3 or 4 to the legislative committee that confirmed him, and then the rest to the grand jury. And I'll tell you, as a legislator, I think it's a big story because, to my knowledge, this is the first time anyone has been charged with perjury or lying under oath at a committee meeting of the legislature. And there's been a lot of times when I believed individuals were given false testimony. And I suspect now that this has happened, people will be a little more forthcoming at legislative committees in the future.
Well, it was known that Mr. Greenstein worked for this company, CNSI. I think it was almost a given that he would be an advocate for them. But what were the questions that involved the alleged perjury?
Well, as I understand it, he indicated that he had built a wall of separation between himself and the rest of DHH as to how that contract was going to be awarded, which may not have been the case. I think he said that he didn't know whether CNSI was initially ineligible to bid on the contract, but he had the department changed the eligibility requirements in a way that made CNSI eligible to bid on the contract. And he said that there had been no communications between himself and the folks at CNSI during this process. And as I understand it, there were thousands of communications in text messages and otherwise between Secretary Greenstein and CNSI. And then, of course, I think some of these same statements were repeated at the grand jury. I'm not making an independent determination that he committed perjury, but it's my understanding that those are the questions and answers that are at issue.
Well, his attorney, John McClendon, says it's a big misunderstanding, and that's what he says regarding Mr. Greenstein, who now lives in Seattle, Washington. Now, the governor of Louisiana held this same position under Governor Foster, it would seem that he would have known about Mr. Greenstein's involvement with CNSI. Is the governor complicit in any kind of deal that may or may not have come down?
Well, I'm not prepared to say he was complicit in that he had personal knowledge in what Secretary Greenstein was doing, or that he had personal knowledge that Greenstein was saying things that were untrue. What we do know is when this thing blew up, he allowed Greenstein to resign but then stay on the job for a month and then wrote a resignation letter praising Governor Jindal and especially his transition of the Medicaid program from a fee-for-service to a capitated program, what we now know is Bayou Health. And so clearly the governor didn't have much of a sense of an urgency or an understanding of how serious this issue was, or if he did have an understanding, he certainly didn't respond appropriately.
297-5633, we'll take a few calls if you'd like to pose them to John Bell Edwards, and we have some emails that are flurrying in as well. Bruce Greenstein, the former Secretary of Health, indicted yesterday on 9 counts of perjury related to his involvement in the award of a $200 million state government contract to CNSI. The grand jury returned the charges to District Judge Lou Daniel of Baton Rouge, who is a conservative Republican. John Bell Edwards, running for governor, not as a conservative Republican, but how would you qualify your political slant? Yesterday, Senator Landrieu said definitively, she says, "I've never been a conservative, I'm a moderate." What are you, John Bell Edwards?
Well, you know, I think those labels are often misleading because what I prefer to do is tell someone where I stand issue by issue and let them make the determination. I believe that I am a moderate Democrat that is faithful to the Louisiana tradition of folks like Bennett Johnson and John Breaux and others, socially conservative on a number of issues, including, for example, the pro-life issues and the Second Amendment gun rights. But I also have a strong belief that government ought to work for the benefit of people, and that it is legitimate for government to make sure the working poor have access to health care, and especially if our taxpayers are going to be paying federal taxes that are covering that cost, we ought to be affording that health care to our people through the Medicaid expansion so that those dollars flow to our hospitals, clinics, and doctors and not to those in other states so that their people who are working poor can get care. You know, if that last position is liberal, then it's liberal. But I happen to believe it's a conservative thing to actually take advantage of the tax dollars that you're paying in your own state as opposed to allowing other people to do that.
Question from Edwin, who asked John Bell Edwards, do you plan to file suit against the governor for his handling of the state insurance program?
Well, I do not plan to file suit. I'm an attorney myself. I believe that to have standing, you would have to be an OGB member who has suffered some adverse consequence, perhaps having to pay more out of pocket than they would have otherwise as a result of their illegal modification of existing plans and implementation of new plans that may be done before they've actually gone all the way through the rulemaking process.
You're a graduate of West Point, spent several years in the U.S. Army, John Bell Edwards did, and the question from a listener, Chris, about Governor Edwards, Governor Jindal, taking aim at President Obama for his handling of the ISIS crisis. Has the governor been fair in his assessment of the president's actions or lack thereof?
Well, I'm not personally familiar with what the governor has said about the president's approach, at least here recently, with respect to ISIS and the airstrikes that are going on in both Iraq and Syria. I just know that at times like this, the tradition in this country has been that people pull together and support whoever the commander-in-chief is, especially at the outset of these types of operations. And I would hope that would be done in this case and that any benefit of the doubt be resolved in favor of the president, who, as best as I can tell, is doing what the conservatives in this country have been calling for a while. And their biggest complaint seems to be he's a little late, but they are in general agreement with his overall approach at this time, I believe. So I'm not prepared to say whether Jindal's out of bounds on this or not. I can tell you that Jindal ought to be paying more attention to what's happening in the state of Louisiana, to the people that elected him to govern them. And if he did, and if he didn't have contempt for state workers and retirees and school teachers and college professors and contempt for the law, we wouldn't be talking about this officer group benefits fiasco as we are.
Well, as I mentioned, he has been traveling extensively, and most recently trips to Iowa and New Hampshire, the first stops on the 2016 presidential primary and caucus tour. So it looks like the man's running for president of the United States.
Well, I mean, that's the appearance. He says that he hasn't made that determination yet and that he is considering it, and that I guess he has a timeline in mind for when he will tell us. I can only tell you we have enough problems here in Louisiana that deserve his attention, so that we make sure that hospitals don't close their ERs all around the state, as Baton Rouge General proposed or indicated it was going to do, so that we don't proceed as we are presently with the officer group benefits, so that higher education can actually be funded appropriately. We just have so many problems right here in Louisiana that demand his attention, that it's perplexing to me that he would choose to absent himself from the state and focus on all these other things that are not part and parcel of what he was elected to do.
All right. Barbara asks, for these trips the governor is taking on these campaign swings, who is paying for the freight? Who's the taxpayers involved at all?
Well, I'm sure that taxpayers are involved in some degree. At least previously we knew that state policemen were traveling with him, and he was not, through his campaign or otherwise, reimbursing the state for that cost. I believe that if he, for example, flies back into New Orleans on one of these out-of-state trips, I think his transportation from New Orleans to Baton Rouge is often by helicopter, and it's not something that it's a bill that the taxpayers are paying. So there's certainly some freight that we're paying, but the other thing is we're paying him to be a full-time public servant to the people of Louisiana, and he's drawing that salary for a number of days when he's not in Louisiana and not tending to Louisiana business. So certainly the taxpayers mm-hmm. are paying at least a significant portion of the overall cost of his travels.
Should he reimburse the state anything?
Sure he should.
What, the salary that he receives while he's campaigning?
No, but he ought to at least reimburse the pro rata cost of his transportation expenses that are related to purely political out-of-state trips. With respect to the state police bodyguards and security details that he's taken with him, he's got enough money in his campaign account that he can reimburse for that as well.
Lastly, what's the next step on the situation regarding group benefits?
Well, there's going to be a committee meeting tomorrow in the House of Representatives. The Appropriations Committee is going to meet at 10 a.m. It will be a full-blown meeting where members of the public can come in and testify, and we'll have folks from the administration and folks from the different employee groups who will be there to testify, and we'll be able to ask questions and hopefully exercise a little bit of our oversight authority and shine some light on what's going on and make sure that we bring it to the administration's attention that we expect them to follow the law and do things properly. And
thank you very much, John Bell Edwards. We'll be back. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and our guest is Michael H. Rubin. His novel is The Cotton Crest Curse, and Michael Rubin practices law full-time, but he's also a former professional jazz pianist. So you are a Renaissance man. Do you still play the piano?
Every day.
Yeah?
Yeah, I love playing the piano. I think playing a piano is like writing a novel. When you're a jazz pianist, you work around a theme, and you expand upon that theme. And I think novel writing is that. You take a plot and the characters, and you make them your own.
And you have to have discipline, which I guess you do as a lawyer as well, at least the good ones.
One tries to have discipline in everything one does. And, you know, we all find time, Jim, to do those things that we enjoy. And I enjoy playing piano, I enjoy writing, and I enjoy being a lawyer. So I try to find time for all of those.
Well, tell us about The Cotton Crest Curse.
The Cotton Crest Curse is a multi-generational thriller that runs from the cotton fields to the courthouse steps, from Cajun bayous into the bordellos of 19th century New Orleans, and on into the Freedom Riders of the 1960s and into the present. At the heart of the book is a murder mystery. Generations of owners of the Cotton Crest Plantation have died mysterious deaths, and the question is, are they linked? And although it's called a curse, there are no werewolves, there are no magic. It is, at the base, a murder mystery.
You set it up well, and it sounds like you're a man who's read a murder novel a time or two.
I love anything that causes you at the end of the chapter to say, all right, I'll just read a couple of more words to see what happens next, and whether that's a mystery or a history or science fiction or Sherlock Holmes, I think that's the mark of a good writer who is able to latch that reader into the world.
And you're mixing both mystery and history here.
That is. It is historically accurate. I'm pleased to say that the Cotton Crest Curse is published by the LSU Press, which is the same ones who did the Confederacy of Dunces and the annotated 12 Years a Slave. And, of course, they had the publication vetted by historians. Mm-hmm. So although it is a fictional character and a fictional plantation, it takes place in a historically accurate setting.
And that setting is?
That setting is Louisiana from the Civil War up to the Civil Rights era, and there are key characters who were there who were real people, like Louis Martinet, who was a black lawyer who was behind the Plessy versus Ferguson case, which is the separate but equal case, which is in the book, and the Civil Rights marches of the 1960s, and what happened during Reconstruction.
297-5633 is your number for Michael Rubin, a lawyer, a pianist, and a novelist. The book is The Cotton Crest Curse, about a plantation. And plantations, we have an abundance of them, but they have a history, both good and bad.
They have a history, both good and bad, which is what I wanted to write about. They were the center of commerce. They were the center of power for good and for evil. And the question is, where is the truth in anything? In fact, the novel deals with three big questions, which is, first, can we really know all there is to know about our ancestors? Do we really know what our great-great-grandparents were like? And if we did, would that change our image of who we were? But perhaps most importantly, it deals with truth. Do we know what truth is? And if there's something that comes along, Jim, that I know is true, that really helps you, that I know well, and really hurts somebody else, what do I do? Do I tell the truth and help you and mm-hmm. hurt somebody else, or do I remain silent? And that's what this novel's about.
Well, Louisiana, since you're blending the past and the present, it's a state that has one-third African Americans, and their arrival in this state was not a pleasant thing. That's one of the stains on our country's past and on this state's past. But nonetheless, the blend of people we have of all ethnic varieties, it's a strength today, or it should be.
Well, you know, we want to say that our state's a gumbo, and a gumbo is a good thing. But the novel deals with the dark side of Louisiana and the slaves that happened, and the Jim Crow laws that occurred, the horrible Jim Crow laws that occurred in the post Civil War, post Reconstruction era, and their impact not only on blacks but on immigrants and on religion are all dealt with in the book.
Prejudice against all kinds of people during the centuries of Louisiana.
That's right. And in fact, part of the question is our prejudice one that is inborn, or is it because of who we perceive we are? And if we knew something different about our past, would that alter our perceptions and perhaps eliminate our prejudices?
Is it a part of the human condition to have somebody to look down upon?
I don't know whether it's part of the human condition, but certainly it's a part of many cultural traditions. And one of the questions the book asks is, do we allow our peers to make up our moral compass, or do we have our own?
Mm-hmm. How was it for black people who worked on these plantations, who were in many cases victimized? And when I say many, I guess almost all cases victimized by the people who were running the place. Couldn't have been an easy life.
Could not have been. And as a white person, I can only imagine how horrible that was. I know what anti-Semitism was like, and I deal with both. In fact, one of the strong characters and one of the key protagonists in the book is a lady named Jenny in the post-Reconstruction South, the daughter of a slave who speaks French and therefore is trusted because of that and suspected because of that, as well as two former slaves on the plantation who play key roles in the book.
The book is The Cotton Crest Curse, a novel from Michael Rubin, and it's from LSU Press, the same group that brought us 12 Years a Slave.
That's right. 12 Years a Slave was thought of as a fiction book when it first came out in the late 1800s. And two historians did the research and published through the LSU Press and annotated 12 Years a Slave, proving that it was factual and true, and that became the basis of the movie.
And this is consistent with that time and that place, the place being Louisiana. You being a person who spent a lot of time here, Louisiana is a place not only that stimulates the creative juices, but it has a history that is fertile for exploration, and you've done just that.
Well, thank you, and I've tried to make it, though, not just about Louisiana, but about the South in general, and plantations, whether they're in Louisiana or in Alabama or in Mississippi, were all the center of commerce, industry, money, and power, for good and for evil.
Michael Rubin, you've written before.
Yes, I have. This is my first fiction book, although I've had a hand in over 40 articles and periodicals, and I've been a writer, a co-writer of 13 nonfiction books.
Nonfiction books, yep. And some of those?
Those are all legal books, and you need really strong coffee with lots of caffeine for those, because they got no pictures and lots of footnotes.
No pictures and lots of footnotes, but you can craft a phrase and create a picture, and Louisiana... you capture Governor Pinchback. People forget that Louisiana, with all our foibles, had the first African-American governor in American history.
First African-American governor during Reconstruction, and served for 15 days, and was a remarkable man, and he's in the book. And the story of what happened when the Great Compromise of 1877 came along, which pulled the federal troops out of the South, and where Rutherford B. Hayes became president and ended Reconstruction and brought the beginning of the Jim Crow era is in the book as well.
In the Jim Crow era, it didn't last a decade. It didn't last a generation. It lasted a very long time.
It began officially when the U.S. Supreme Court in Plessy versus Ferguson, a case that began in Louisiana with a train ride to Covington. The Louisiana Supreme Court said that segregation was lawful and went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And they said, separate but equal. And it took until the 1950s, Brown versus Board of Education, to overturn that, a terrible period of time between Plessy and Brown. And both of those are in the book as well.
And Brown was 1954, correct?
1954.
Well, that just didn't wipe the slate clean.
No, of course. And in fact, it took it. The Brown case said with all deliberate speed, and it took generations even for that to do. And the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals and federal judges were charged primarily in the South with making that happen.
James Carville writes, Michael Rubin proves himself to be an exceptional storyteller in his novel The Cotton Crest Curse. The powerful epic is expertly composed in both its historical content and beautifully constructed scenery. I highly recommend picking up this book to catch a glimpse into life and conflict during the height of the Old South. How much of the Old South is still with us?
Well, the question is, what is your perception of the Old South? If the Old South is a horrible, terrible place of prejudice, I hope it doesn't exist at all. If the Old South is one of tradition that honors tradition without honoring prejudice, I think it's a wonderful place to be.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, people ask me about the book, and they say, well, is this historical fiction or is this a thriller? And I say, yes, it's both. I didn't write it with a niche in mind. But as I said, it runs for 100 years, and it deals with historically accurate things, but it is designed as a page-turning thriller.
It is a page-turning thriller from a man who has many interests, Michael Rubin, lawyer, pianist, and novelist, and he has written about his homeland and ours, Louisiana, in a way that few others can, because you've lived it, you know it, you've studied it, and it's right here in The Cotton Crest Curse, a novel from our guest Michael Rubin. 297-5633 if you would like to join the conversation. Tell us about Jenny.
Jenny is one of the key characters. Jenny is a daughter of a slave, speaks French, is a translator, therefore, for many people who do not speak French, and therefore is trusted by some because of that and suspected by some, and she becomes the key along with Jake. So let me tell you how both get involved. Two decades after the end of the Civil War, elderly Colonel Augustine Chastain viciously slit the throat of his beautiful young wife and fatally shot himself. But his death was not the first suicide of an owner of the Cotton Crest Plantation, and it was not to be the last. Or maybe it was a double homicide. An itinerant peddler, Jake Gold, is suspected of the murder, and Jenny gets involved, and both become suspects, and both have to run to save themselves and others.
Jake and Jenny.
That's right.
On the pages of the Cotton Crest Curse. Now, Michael is making the rounds today. He'll speak at the Rotary Club. In fact, your address today is on...
My address today is on social media and what business people ought to know about the traps of social media.
You won't be discussing the Jim Crow South, probably.
I will not be discussing the book, but I will be discussing issues about social media and hopefully in a way that simulates discussion and is humorous.
And then the Foundation for Historical Louisiana has you front and center tomorrow, I think.
That's right. There's a book launch party, 6 p.m. at the Foundation for Historical Louisiana. I've been around the country already on book tours. I was at Octavia Bookstore last night doing a book signing. I was in Norfolk, Virginia at the Southern Independent Booksellers Association trade show just a few days ago.
Well, how does a man who is so knowledgeable about history and Southern history also have an expertise in social media?
Well, one of the things I speak about 30 or 40 times a year around the country on various topics, and one of the topics I talk on is the legal implications of use of social media, things that people don't think about. For example, should employers have social media policies? Should employees be able to get on social media during work hours, and what are the implications?
Mm-hmm. If social media had been available during this time, the time you're writing about in the Cotton Crest Curse, how would that have changed the life of the people who are on the pages of your book?
Well, I think that's a great question, Jim, because I think one of the things that history tells us is that communications become an issue. And if there's instantaneous communications, that alters how we behave. Sometimes it prevents us from interacting with people, and sometimes it makes us interact more. In this book, the lack of communications plays a role.
Well, imagine, for example, the invasion in Normandy. Mm-hmm. Couldn't be done today because of these phones. Hitler would have known about it.
Well, we all have a great breadth of knowledge, and sometimes not much depth, but we have a great breadth of knowledge of many things because of social media. And hopefully what this book does is give people a more deeper understanding of Louisiana, but in ways that are pleasurable and not as a historical tract.
All right. 297-5633. Linda on Congress asks about Code Noir.
Code Noir. Code Noir. The French Code Noir was the Black Code of Louisiana. Came in when the French governed Louisiana prior to the Louisiana Purchase. And the first article said Jews had to be expelled from the colony. And the fourth article dealt with slavery. It was a terrible article, and it was a terrible situation. And Louisiana has a history of race and religion built into its law.
And when was this?
Pre-1803.
So prior to the Louisiana Purchase.
Prior to the Louisiana Purchase. When Louisiana had a flip-flop history. It was Spanish, then French, then Spanish, then French.
You're saying the discrimination against black people also included discrimination against Jews.
That's right. From the very first.
And who was responsible for this?
The French. It was in the Code Noir.
And all these years later, there's still prejudice, of course. But we do have a chance of having a Jewish governor next year. We talked with Gus Weil about it, considering that a couple of centuries ago, he certainly wouldn't have been welcome. That's significant.
It is significant. We've come a long way. We have we had a black governor in the 1890s. We have in the 1870s. We have black legislators today. We have black mayors. I think we've come a tremendous amount. We have ways to go still.
Yes, we do. But studying the past sometimes is important to progress today.
I think if we have an illusion about the past, it prevents us from dealing with it accurately. But if we know what happened in the past, if we have a really understanding, I think it helps illuminate where we ought to be going.
When you look at our past, it's hard to believe that we survived this.
Well, it is, but I think it's a symbol of the strength of Louisiana people. I will tell you that in working on the Cotton Crest Curse, my wife and I worked on the plot as we walked every morning early. We walk at 4:30 every morning and talking about the characters in the plot. And we wanted to find some way to deal with Louisiana in a positive way that was a thriller and yet illustrated history.
Did you walk this morning?
We did not walk this morning, but then we were
out prepping for this show, right?
but we will walk tomorrow.
And prepping for his address at the Rotary Club. So Michael Rubin is making the rounds, and the Rotary is, of course, to members. But the Foundation for Historical Louisiana, that's open to the public.
Open to the public, 6 p.m. Thursday night, Governor's Mansion, yeah.
Old Governor's Mansion. I'm sure Carolyn Bennett will be there and calling the shots, as she usually mm-hmm. does, and should be a nice turnout for Michael Rubin, and you will be talking about the Cotton Crest Curse.
In fact, I'll do more than just talk about it. I'll have a multimedia presentation about the history and background of the book and a short book reading and a book signing. So it'll
we
give
have
you,
some books there?
I will have books there.
Okay. Michael Rubin, tomorrow at the Foundation for Historical Louisiana Old Governor's Mansion at 6 o'clock?
6 p.m.
All right, and we thank you for joining us today. Congratulations on a compelling novel.
Thanks, Jim. It's a pleasure being here.
Sounds like you're ready to do it again.
I have two more in the works.
Thank you, Michael. And thanks for listening, everybody. For Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Inkster. We shall return tomorrow. Until then, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.